The committee will come to order. Please take your seats. Being just short of a quorum, we'll wait until we get a quorum before we do the minutes of the last meeting. So we'll begin with our agenda, listening to Legacy Fund recipient presentations this afternoon, starting with the Outdoor Heritage Council, Mr. Becker. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Chair Erdahl. I'm Bill Becker. I'm the Executive Director of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. And I'm pleased to be with you today to give you an overview of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council's method of producing recommendations for that fund. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce my staff, Heather Cooke, behind me, and Sandy Smith. I want to make the point that we're here to serve you as nonpartisan staff. So we're staff to you, we're staff to your staff. I'd also like to recognize member Les Bench, who's in the audience behind me. He's one of the inaugural members of the council. The Outdoor Heritage Fund. The Outdoor Heritage Fund is a constitutional fund that receives one-third of the tax raised by the Legacy Amendment. There was a delay in the imposition of tax and collection, so we saw the first of funds deposited in October of 2009. Spending out of the projected receipts to the fund so that we're spending out of projected receipts to the fund, so cash flow is an issue, accuracy of projections is an issue. Therefore, we keep a 10% cushion in the fund. If collections fall short, appropriations must be reduced. That's why we have the 10% cushion. We think it will avoid that. The Constitution limits the use of Outdoor Heritage Fund to expenditures that restore, protect, and enhance prairies, wetlands, forests, and other habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. It can't substitute for traditional sources of funding. It must supplement traditional sources of funding. And the Council is a legislative body. So we, like this committee, are part of the legislature. There are 12 members, 8 citizen members, and 4 legislative members. The 8 citizen members are made up of 2 public members appointed by the Senate, and 2 public members appointed by the Speaker of the House, and 4 public members appointed by the Governor. The 4 legislative members are made up of 2 members of the Senate, 1 majority and 1 minority, and 2 members of the House of Representatives, 1 majority and 1 minority, appointed by the Speaker of the House. It's important to note that members are advisory to the Minnesota Legislature. The duties of the Council. The Council makes annual recommendations to the Legislature. We recommend you appropriate. We prepare and maintain the Outdoor Heritage Fund plan and 25-year framework. We are statutorily mandated to create a conservation partners program. We manage conflicts of interest within the council using the procedures of the state. And we oversee projects receiving outdoor heritage funds on behalf of the legislature to ensure that the projects in fact produce what the legislature intended. The Conservation Partners Program is a special program that was designed to strengthen citizen involvement in conservation, and we'll get into more detail on that later. The Council has produced a vision and priority plan. First, we divided the state into logical geographic areas for planning purposes, and these are based on the DNR ecoregions, ecological sections, I believe is the technical term. We looked at existing habitat plans, developed a vision, priority, and spending target for each geographic section with input from local conservation professionals who we rely on heavily, the public, and field issue review. Those geographically specific visions and priorities became part of our call for requests, which you have in your packet. It looks like this. These are the ecological sections that we use for planning purposes. They will be familiar to many of you who have followed the Department of Natural Resources over the last 15 to 20 years. Let's talk a little bit about the 25-year funding framework. It was delivered to the Legislative Coordinating Commission on January the 15th as required by law. In addition to the plan, we prepared this 25-year funding framework. And what the framework does is it puts bounds on the possible outcomes. It provides sideboards and directions for future use of the fund. And again, we use conservation professionals to develop the framework. What is the 25-year framework? It explores the scope of current conservation efforts. How much, where is it, how much is already protected, how much do we restore and enhance. It explores and tests the limits of accomplishment with the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and it explores the impact of continued use of the fund as it has been used in the past. The framework has the following conclusions. The Outdoor Heritage Fund doubles conservation while increasing the rate of restoration and enhancement by 10%. Need exceeds capacity despite the new funding. We asked professionals around the state what the need was in terms of acres and dollars for conservation of prairies, forests, wetlands, and other habitat. And that far outstrips what can be reached by the current funding and the capacity of the new funding. And it also indicates that the future is hard to predict. Just a little bit about the council's call for requests so you can get a flavor for who's participating. The plan and framework feed into our recommendation development process. It's important that it's an open process. The council seeks ongoing programs addressing its visions and priorities. We hope to continually fund these programs to ensure a legacy remains after 25 years. So the concept is, if you find a program that is achieving the objectives that you have as a council, invest in that over and over and over again so that you achieve those objectives after 25 years. It's utmost concern of the council that in 25 years we'd be able to look back and see a palpable, feelable, tangible result from these investments. The other thing that we've noticed in the call for request is that the capacity for conservation in Minnesota is limited, so we seek to build capacity, and we seek to fund a variety of types of recipients, private and public alike. Give you a flavor of who gets the recipients of the funds. This is a list of the non-governmental organizations and governmental organizations that are funded by the primary recommendations of the council, plus there are the recipients of the conservation partner grants. The conservation partner grants provides a supplemental avenue to the funds for grants up to $400,000, and in the upcoming recommendation we have a small grant program built into it for grants under $25,000 with less red tape. The council recommendation process objectives. In developing recommendations, we seek to use science, be transparent and accessible, use the fund in the public interest, follow existing habitat plans, and balance the recommendations across Minnesota. In making the recommendations, the council has a number of considerations that they take into account. The major issues that are integrated into the recommendation process are payment in lieu of taxes, the condition of public land, substitution risks, the use of other constitutional funds, bonding, land ownership, and leverage. So as we debate and do our due diligence, those are items that come up in the discussions by the council. The steps to the process, it's a series of meetings from June through December, including statewide issue tours to receive public testimony, public call for requests. The items in blue in this list are the steps that we perform in which we perform due diligence by talking with program managers, and asking them to testify on their proposals. The council plugs into the legislative process by providing a jacketed bill to the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leaders, and then the recommendations bill is processed in the usual manner. Recommendations to date. We've put $134 million to work to date in two rounds of funding. 42 programs have been funded by the legislature, and 69 projects have been funded by the Conservation Partner Legacy Grant Program, totaling approximately $8 million. I hear from time to time that the same people get the money, but I think that, and it's just a few people who get the recommendations, but I think that this slide tells a different story with over 100 recipients in 2 years.
Mr. Becker, how many applications get turned down?
Very good question. We last time, for example, had in mid-40s in terms of applications to the council's recommendations, and we funded approximately 26, I believe. We heard most of the 26. There were very few programs that were heard that weren't funded. We did not hear all 45 of the programs, the proposals.
Thank you.
Some examples of things that we've recommended funding for: Minnesota Department of Natural Resources for Forests for the Futures, which was an appropriation of $36 million, provided for 190,000 acres in permanent conservation easement on industrial forest land. The benefits include prevention of forest fragmentation, encouraging a sustainable working forest, significant habitat value, and the land remains in the tax base. Another example is the Prairie Heritage Fund, which acquires and restores prairie and grasslands. That's an appropriation through the Department of Natural Resources to Pheasants Forever. We've recommended, and you all have appropriated, two appropriations totaling $6 million to protect 3,400 acres of prairie grassland to eventually become wildlife management areas. The public benefits includes prevention of includes high-quality habitat complexes and corridors, slowing or reversing the loss of habitat, water quality benefits, public hunting and other recreation, and aids in declining non-game wildlife populations. A third example is the aquatic management areas acquisition. This is with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This was two appropriations totaling $9 million to restore, protect, and enhance 70 miles of shoreline river streams around the state. It results in the public benefits of protecting and restoring priority habitats. It results in angling opportunities, water quality, and improved aquatic systems through channel restoration, dam modification, and shoreline enhancement. Accelerated shallow lake restoration and enhancement is a primary program of the council and the legislature. It's received two appropriations totaling $9 million to restore and enhance over 8,000 acres of wetlands and wetland systems. And just to note on this, this is building the capacity for doing this kind of work as well as actually doing it. The engineering is involved, pre-engineering, those kinds of costs. The public benefit includes migrating and nesting opportunities, control of invasive species through water level control, seasonal water, keeping seasonal water on the land, and assisting with water quality and flood control. Lastly, as an example, the Coldwater River and Stream Restoration Protection and Enhancement is an appropriation to Minnesota Trout Unlimited, totaling about $3.3 million, affecting 19 miles of Coldwater Stream. The restoration and enhancement done by the council, it often appears to be rather pricey and expensive. This is one of the reasons. It is a costly undertaking to go into a stream and restore the banks, restore the stream channel, things of that sort. But the public benefits include reduced stream bank erosion, it reconnects streams to their floodplains, increases natural reproduction of trout, increases adult trout abundance, and enhances angling opportunities. So those are some examples of what we funded today. Measures of success today. This is a measured in acres. Acres are outputs. In the long run, we're hoping to develop outcomes rather than outputs to measure success in the future. Only a portion of the fee acquisition is PILT related. We seek to work with programs to ensure we're getting quality land, not just any land, but the right land. And we do that through strategic acquisition, ensuring land reserved is in the right place relative to other habitat, and precision acquisition, reserving only a portion of acquired lands. We encourage those who are acquiring land with these funds to be precise in what they need for habitat. If they acquire 640 acres and only 100 of it is really key for the habitat complex that's involved, we encourage and request they divest of the remainder of the land. That's precision acquisition. Precision acquisition is acquiring land in the right place. The distribution of this geographically, most counties have seen a project. I think in your packet you have a map of the state of Minnesota showing the location of all the projects that have been recommended in the first 2 years, with the exception of the Conservation Partners projects. They're not on this particular map. Another way to look at the measures of success is acres by biome or ecotype. The emphasis apparently based on this data has been on forests and prairies, with approximately 200,000 acres of forest land affected and approximately 52,000 acres of prairie have been protected, restored, or enhanced. In summary, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is constitutionally dedicated to protecting, restoring, and enhancing Minnesota's forests, prairies, wetlands, and habitat in general. It must not substitute for traditional funding. The council makes recommendations to the legislature on the use of the fund the legislature appropriates. The process is open, thoughtful, and deliberate, and the council tries to be disciplined, keeping its recommendations focused on their objectives. So, as I said in the beginning, we're nonpartisan staff. We're your staff. Our offices are right around the corner in G95. We would welcome anybody who has a question about any of the programs or the projects or the council itself. And I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. First, do you have a tabulation of how much money was expended in each of the biomes?
I do have a tabulation. We will get that to you in each of the biomes.
Each of the five areas on the map.
Yes, we have that. We'll deliver that to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that. And also, Mr. Becker, I mean, there are those who are asserting that the state already owns too much land, and in fact are proposing to dispose of some of the land that the state of Minnesota owns. What is your response to the comment that we own too much land already?
Well, I think in a sense that's barking up the wrong tree. The question is, do we own the right land? Is the land distributed correctly in the right place? And that ought to be the focus of state policy, is to make sure that the state owns the right habitat land to have the productivity that's necessary to support the fish, wildlife, and ecosystems of Minnesota. So I don't think that a land moratorium, acquisition moratorium, is the right idea. I don't think a no net gain or no net loss is the right idea. I think having land in the right place in the public sector is the right idea, and that's where the state ought to focus.
Thank you. Members, Representative Wagenius.
Right land in the right place is a good criteria. DNR has a list of the best of the best in their list of scientific and natural areas that they would like to purchase. And I think the list right now has gotten up to $68 million. That's kind of what it was the last time I saw it anyway. How much of this money was used to purchase that, the lands on DNR's scientific and natural area list.
I don't have the precise figure, Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius. I don't have the precise figure with me today. I did look at that recently, and it's under $5 million of the money that's gone to scientific and natural areas. We do acquire scientific and natural areas. There's not a particular appropriation for them. They are integrated into the lists of the forest acquisition, AMA acquisition, and wildlife management area acquisition.
Representative Wagenius?
Let me follow up with that. What I hear you're saying, and I may be wrong about this, is that you do get acquire some scientific and natural areas when you acquire other parcels. I am asking specifically about the list that DNR has identified and has been carrying for a while of what they consider the best of the best.
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I can only assume that that list drives the programs in DNR. If it does, then we're acquiring off that list. But the amount that we've taken off of it, we'd have to look into and get that information back to you.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Be happy to.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Becker, you got a ruling, I believe it was last year, it may have been in the first year of the council, from our Attorney General in regards to opinion about how some of the money could be used in regards to maintenance, for lack of a better term. Are you familiar with that, and can you give me a synopsis of that opinion, or would you prefer to have the Attorney General's office ask that? I'd like to hear about that opinion a little bit.
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'll do the following. We'll get you the not opinion, since there was nothing in contention. The Attorney General wouldn't issue an opinion. They would issue some thoughts about a particular question. And the question had to do with whether it was constitutional to use the fund to pay payment in lieu of taxes. And the general gist of the Attorney General's opinion was that it wasn't. And the reasons are varied, but the one that sticks in my mind the most is that payment in lieu of taxes is used to fund schools, police, fire, roads at the local level. And those aren't constitutional uses of the fund. I think there's some other issues as well. Currently, there is a source of funds for payment in lieu. It comes out of the general fund. It's the traditional source. Using this fund to pay payment in lieu would be substituting for the traditional source. That's what they said. I think the best thing for me to do is to get the committee a copy of the letter.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Becker, I appreciate maybe where the Attorney General was going, and I'm not sure if it was her opinion or one of the staff, but most of us, if we decide to expand our home or move into a new home, we make preparations that maybe our taxes are going to go up, or that we may have to fix the plumbing someday or put a new concrete floor in a garage or whatever. And when we make a decision to buy, we realize that there's expenses involved with that. So I'm thinking that maybe we should revisit that, and I don't know that the people that voted for the amendment, including myself, really expected somebody else to fix our concrete and pay for our new and bigger garage. I think we were thinking if we were going to get that we were going to pay our own way. And in this day of people questioning how much land we should own, I think this amendment passed because people wanted more land, but I think they realized that we should be paying our own fair share along the way. So I look forward to this discussion, and I think it's one that we need to have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative McNamara, I don't know that there was a question there, but I'm going to stick my neck out here and say I think it's wise public policy to take a look at that question.
Thank you.
Representative Perkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Becker, thank you for coming to our committee today. I just like to return briefly to the page about the trout stream restoration. And I did some back of the matchbook math here, and it seems like it's about costing about $173,000 per mile to do that work. That seems costly. Could you just inform us a little bit on why that's so expensive?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, a mile's a fur piece, so I can start out there. It's a lot of land. These are completely remaking the stream. These streams have been heavily degraded by erosion, slumping of banks, silting in of the beds. This requires a fair amount of heavy equipment use. They are dealing with large boulders in the ton range. The resource with which they're dealing is an extremely sensitive resource and requires especially trained professionals to do, and special design and engineering, which is included in this price. This is on here because this is one of the things in conservation that hasn't been done for so many years because of the mere cost of it. And lastly, these are made to last. They're durable. They'll be there for years and years and years and years. So the cost per year isn't that great.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. An unrelated question, actually. Could you briefly outline the administrative costs involved in the administration of these funds?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, by statute, we're authorized to use 1% of the fund for administration. We use approximately 0.5% the future, we'll bring the bill before you with our recommendations that has the administrative account in it. We are suggesting $471,000 per fiscal year to administer $85 million a year, basically. I might add that these are three-year appropriations, so the liability, the workload is building. But I think we can handle it with the staff that we have. It is a slim staff.
Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, I was interested in your comment on slide 22, which is measures of success to date. And I think you correctly commented that these were a measure of outputs, not outcomes, and that you were developing or hope to soon develop a list of a set of measurable outcomes. I guess I'd like to, I'm new to this, and through every presentation I see generous funding, good intentions, generally the right values and the right kind of program ideas, the right sorts of things that I think were the kind of heart of this amendment. But what I don't know is what we're supposed to be funding towards. It seems to me that just putting money towards something without a clear idea of the specific outcome is a really good way of having money kind of go all over the place without being well managed. And so I wonder if you could elaborate more on the outcomes section that you referred to.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Winkler, I would be happy to. This is not a question I spent a lot of time thinking about in anticipation, but I want to lead by saying that it's generally thought that this particular account is dedicated toward habitat. So what we're looking for is changes, measurable changes, in the amount of habitat that's available to fish, game, and wildlife, and that supports the ecosystems of Minnesota. When I talk about outputs versus outcomes, what we're unable to do at this particular point in time is measure what that habitat does. how many pairs of nesting ducks does it support? How many red-winged blackbirds does it support? And that's where we've got to get a better idea. How important is the habitat we're buying for the ecological fabric of a particular ecosystem, the prairie ecosystem? Are we really going forward in acquiring enough prairie in the right place of the right quality and restoring enough prairie in the right place and the right quality to ensure that we have a substantial, significant prairie ecosystem in perpetuity in Minnesota? It is the legacy fund. That is the legacy. The legacy isn't acres of land. The legacy is habitat and the products of that habitat.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler,
and I guess I would, Mr. Becker, take a couple more, I guess, points beyond that. The first is, how do you actually know that what your the programs are actually delivering the habitat improvements? And because I mean, I imagine that there are so many variables and factors into determining the number of nesting ducks that we have. That it's hard to know what the product of the programs are, and then but then the related question is, how many ducks do we want? What's the I'm a hunter. I like to see game. I'm a fisherman. I like to see fish, but when you've got hundreds of millions of dollars, I know that we want an education. We want higher test scores and to close the achievement gap. Is there a duck gap, or is there something that you can refer us to that would give a sense of where we are in habitat and wildlife and where we're supposed to be?
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, it's a fantastic question. How do we know? Know is a pretty strong word, and I'm not sure that we do know. But I think we have a general have the ability to have a general idea of given certain densities of habitat and locations of types of habitat, what it will produce. There are models that are being developed, some that have been developed for Minnesota, particular places in Minnesota, that do that kind of estimation. They're generally predicated on species guild, so you would talk about waterfowl and goldwing warblers and the other species that are associated with them. And they can predict how many species pairs will occupy this particular property and what the reproductive rate will be. But I think there's another way to look at this. And these are public funds. They ought to produce public benefits. And I think on the macro level, the question really are we seeing a long-term trend of more wildlife or less wildlife, whether that be in Christmas bird counts, or the County Biological Survey and what it's doing, or the, let's face it, the take in the bag, the number of ducks the average hunter takes. Those are all the critical macro things that I think we have to watch. One thing I know for certain, however, is that we got our way into this by problem of a lack of fish wildlife by draining and plow. And the only way we're going to get our way out is by reversing that and protecting what we have left.
My only comment, Mr. Chair, would just be to
short, please, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I aim to be concise.
Okay, thank you.
Is that to have measurable goals aids greatly in the confidence in the programs. Maybe one day we'll have better pheasant hunting in South Dakota, but if that's our goal, we should be explicit about it.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Becker?
Representative Winkler, I'd like good knowledge, wise advice.
Thank you. Representative Cornish has a short comment here, and then we need to move on to the DNR.
My short comment is I think you're doing a great job in to answer that question. I think we're making feeble attempts to get one-tenth of back what we used to have. the oak savannas and the prairies and the wetlands and the stories our grandpa used to, we're never going to get there again. So these crawling steps that we're making are really good. I don't think we've got enough money or enough time to buy enough land that would satisfy me to put back in the shape that it used to be, but that's just a passing comment.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Mr. Becker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
And we'll be talking to you again later on when you bring your request proposals. Commissioner Meyer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, let me just see if I can get...
At this time, we have enough here. We have a quorum. Representative Torkelson moves the approval of the minutes of January 19th.
Thank you.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, thank you for the opportunity to be here in front of you today. You should have a copy of my slides. There are slides in front of you and also a couple other handouts. One entitled Parks and Trails Legacy Report, which is a two-page document that was not stapled. I apologize for that. And another one titled Parks and Trails Legacy Planning that doesn't have any colors or logos on it, but I just want to provide that information for your background as well, as I'll be referring to that. The department is unlike probably any other entity or organization that will be in front of this committee, in that we receive funds from three of the four dedicated accounts that you'll be looking at: Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We also administer the Conservation Partner Legacy Grants Program, and we are the fiscal agent for many of the appropriations that are contained in the bills of the recommendations from the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, the Parks and Trails Fund, and sometimes perhaps the Clean Waters Fund as well, as the legislature cannot appropriate funds directly to a third-party organization. This slide here in front of you outlines the appropriations that the department did receive from these three funds in fiscal years 2010 and 11. The Clean Water Fund, $18.52 million, which includes a $4 million transfer last fiscal year from the PCA to the DNR for metro groundwater monitoring. Parks and Trails funding of $36.9 million. Both of those were a biennial appropriation. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, $127.21 million. That was over two different appropriation periods, two different bills. DNR managed projects or dollars that were directly appropriated to the DNR were about $28 million. The Forest for the Future, Legacy for Forest for the Future, UPM Bland and Kimony Grant Project, or Forest Easement Project, I should say, $36 million, in which we were the fiscal agent for that. Conservation Partner Grants Program for $8.38 million. And then additional pass-through grants that were directed within the appropriations bills from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, totaled $54.83 million, of which Mr. Becker spoke specifically of some examples there. The Clean Water Legacy funding for the department was, like I had said previously, $18.53 million for the fiscal year, for the biennium, of which $3.7 was used for monitoring assessment, $2.1 million for TMDL development, $7.6 for ground or protection and restoration, and $5.13 for drinking water protection. The monitoring and assessment dollars that we were appropriated, we used for stream monitoring, watershed delineation, drainage hydrology, fish contamination assessments, and fish IBI, or it's a biological index monitoring system we use to determine the basically the health of that water ecosystem. You can see some of the outcomes that we have here. We've increased our state-operated real-time water gauges by over 40%. And the number of gauges in the state by 20%. We now have 214 real-time operating stream gauges that provide us data on the quantity of water that's out there, and they're useful during low peak seasons, but also extremely useful during flooding and for us to be able to tell when that water's coming on and where it's coming from. The other things that we have done, we've mapped drainage areas of 257 lakes or the watersheds associated with those. Use state-of-the-art models to assess drainage impacts in three sub-watersheds and increase that IBI, or that fish contamination sampling, contaminant sampling, from 70 to 150 lakes. The TMDL development, we appropriated $2.1 million, and these specifically were used for regional technical assistance for total maximum daily load planning, statewide coordination and watershed and working with the watershed assessment tool. The highlights here are the outcomes. We provided field reconnaissance and technical assistance to support the PCA stress identification for 20 TMDL studies and scored the overall health of the state's 81 major watersheds. Protection and restoration, $7.6 million for the 10 and 11 biennium. These dollars were spent on local community assistance. A large portion was used to fund our LIDAR mapping project, county elite geological atlases, and then a small piece of that was for the Minnesota River Critical Area Rulemaking Project. You can see the outcome highlights there, technical assistance, 32 outreach events, and 8 clean water implementation projects. Collected LIDAR elevation data for 25 counties in the Minnesota River Basin. Improved our county geological atlas data by expanding water chemistry and geological sampling, and engaged the public and key stakeholders in a comprehensive process to review the critical area rules. The LIDAR process that we're in, I don't have a slide on this, just to give you an update, there are still $2.2 million remaining to complete the state with that project, and those dollars would be used to complete the Central Lakes region, which covers all or parts of 11 central Minnesota counties, encompassing about 15,000 square miles. So as I said, the cost of this project to complete the whole state is about $2.2 million, which we can talk about at a later date, Mr. Chair, if you'd like. But that data is essential in helping predict and protect people's livelihoods, their properties, and their farms from flooding. Drinking water protection, we appropriated $5.13 million, and these activities included water supply planning, groundwater monitoring networks, and data management systems. We've accelerated our groundwater monitoring and held stakeholder meetings for aquifer management plans in two of the high-use areas of the state, Moorhead and the Brewton-Belgrade area. We've visited 253 observation well sites in 8 counties, drilled 7 new observation wells, and sealed 16 abandoned wells. As you may recall, this is a key part of the University of Minnesota's groundwater, strategic water framework, is making sure we know where our water is and how much we have before we get to a point where we don't know and we over-appropriate and then cause that chain of events to recur. So we are very fortunate and thankful for the dollars we have received to help us continue down this path. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the Parks and Trails Fund dollars that we appropriated. This is kind of in three different chunks, but one piece of it was for grant dollars, and two pieces are for programmatic activities. We also have a 10-year plan and 25-year framework that was funded out of here, which I'll speak of briefly when we get to that. For the State Parks and Trails legacy dollars, $27.78 million were appropriated. And in the effort of time, Mr. Chairman, these next slides are summarized in high detail on the handouts that I handed you. Unless you want me to go through those, I'm just going to kind of go over them rather quickly. There's a lot of great stuff on there, a lot of outcomes, very specific things we've done, including solar, voltaic opportunities, and things like that. But I'm going to try to stay at a high level here for you.
Appreciate that.
The outcome highlights, you can see 2010, we spent $12.63 million. 2011, we've obligated to, this is January 10th, $6.76 million. The remaining funds will be obligated and spent in the remainder of the fiscal year. Some of the highlights that we've had are outdoor naturalist programs reached over 266,000 participants. Our park usership has increased by over 100,000 people. We've done substantial work on restoring our native plant communities in the state parks and trails. And the photovoltaic passive solar or geothermal systems installed in 5 state parks and 1 rec area. 15 miles of state trail renewal projects. And the Conservation Corps completed almost 71,000 hours of work related to Parks and Trails projects. Talking about the Regional Parks and Trails Grants Program, Mr. Chairman, in FY10, we awarded $3.87 million in grants, of which almost $500,000 was for solar work. In FY11, we awarded over $4.6 million and another $471,000 in solar. The need for this program severely outweighed the ability for us to fund projects. We received over $21 million worth of projects coming in for the park side of it, and over $15 million worth of projects for the trail side that we had to break up with these funds. You can see the highlights of the grant program. 38 for acquisition, development, restoration, maintenance, about $7 million. And then 22 projects for solar at about $1 million, Mr. Chair, members. The Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, this is really exciting here. We're going to be rolling out, mark down on your calendar, February 14th, not just because it's Valentine's Day, but we're going to have a celebration in the Rotunda, I believe at 10 a.m. on that Monday morning, rolling out this project. You're all invited. We want key people who helped us get to this point to be there and be able to speak with us about this. But this has been a massive public participation project. Public review is just finished. We're actually officially delivering the report on the 15th. Hopefully we can meet with you all on that day. But we've outreached to more than 1,000 youth and young adults, meeting with diverse racial and ethnic groups and extensive web-based input for people to tell us what they want, not only the state park system, but the regional and local park system to look like in the next 25 years. With the support of Representative Murphy and others on her committee last year, we were able to get this done. And it's a huge project for us, but we have a map to show us where we want to go and what our system should look like. So thank you very much for that. We look forward to you participating in that important event. Moving on to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, Mr. Chairman, there's two different pots of money here. One's the one that the department is receiving, and then the ones that we pass through. You can see the total appropriations were $57.6 million in 10 and $69.4 in 11. Of that, the DNR managed projects, or projects that the DNR were actually appropriated for, were about $28 million, $36 million for the Forest for the Future program, about $4 million each year for the Conservation Partners program, and then those pass-through projects of almost $55 million. On the DNR project side of it, in 10, it was about $14 million, and 11, almost $14 million again. And these include program level funding for aquatic management areas, wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, forest, prairie bank easement, enhancement and restoration projects, and also forest acquisition. The council and the legislature does a very good job, I think, appropriating these funds to the department at the program level, so then we can apply those dollars to our highest priority needs and conservation values that we have at a precision conservation effort, like Bill Becker was talking about. It is buying the best and trying to protect the rest is what we're all about, and also looking at divesting some of the lands that we don't have at the same time, but that's not the subject of this presentation. Some of the outcome highlights here are 400 of these outdoor rec area projects or restoration enhancement projects are identified and will begin shortly. This is an improvement, an enhancement to WMA, Scientific and Natural Area, some unit of the Outdoor Rec Act. 10 wildlife management area acquisitions have been completed, 11 are underway. 26 aquatic management areas are done or acquired, and 9 are in progress. 6 grants have been written for shoreline habitat projects in the metro, southwest, south central, and north central areas, and also a Little Falls Dam project to improve fish passage was completed. Forest for the Future program, I think most people are aware of this. This is to protect these large blocks of industrial forest land from development, provide access and recreational opportunity perpetually, but also keep those tracts as a working forest. This appropriation of $36 million protected almost 190,000 acres of land up by the Grand Rapids area. The Upper Mississippi Forest Conservation Easement, $34 million, 1,300 acres of fee title acquisition were also included in this appropriation for $300,000. There's a small window of opportunity to complete this program with the balance of the appropriations being used for conservation easement monitoring. You'll see some language establishing this account within the DNR's budget. I'm hopeful these dollars have already appropriated to the DNR, but we need to deposit them into a easement management account related to this project. And also the Forest Capital Kuchiching 4 project, which is a Forest Cap Partners, about 22,000 acre easement project in Itasca, Kuchiching counties. When I say there's a limited opportunity to complete these acquisitions, in the short term of the lifetime of these funds, there's about 2 or 3 more areas of concentration where there are large industrial private land holdings of forest land It's the goal of the Forest for the Future plan, as Representative Winkler was talking about, how do we know how many ducks we're supposed to have or this and that. We have a bunch of citizen plans that, your constituents, our stakeholders, have sat down and developed what their goals are for those types of things. And I will send the committee a link to those strategic plans if that would be appropriate. So you have a link to all of these plans for WMA acquisition, SNA acquisition, AMAs, Force for the Future, to get at some of your questions there. But we're trying to acquire the recreation, the protection, the easement rights on these large tracts of land. So that's something that we'll be talking more about into the future. The Conservation Partner Grants Program, I think most of you are aware of this. This is a $4 million project for grants up to $400,000 to local, state, regional, and national organizations for enhancement, restoration, or protection of forests, wetlands, prairies, and habitat for fish, game, or wildlife in Minnesota. The table here just breaks down some of the grants that were there. Roughly in 10, there was about 36 grants awarded. You can see the acres that were that are proposed to be protected or restored or enhanced. And then in 11, there was about 35 projects with those same outcomes attached to them. The past few grants that we spoke of, and I think Mr. Becker did a great job of highlighting some of these projects. These are the specific projects that stakeholders come to the council with their projects, and the council spends a lot of time vetting the values of these specific projects, the attributes, the outcomes, and then ultimately come up with a recommendation that will be submitted to the legislature. Some of the highlights, we talked about the Trout Unlimited one. Anoka County is completing the acquisition of 275 acres with about $4 million in appropriation. Pheasants Forever, $16.7 million with five grants. Three of the five grants, the land will be transferred to the state. Lands acquired from the other two grants will be transferred to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, making progress on those acquisitions. You can see Ducks Unlimited, $2.5 million for restoration and enhancement of wetlands, $5.5 million for acquisition. Completed projects on about 183 acres of wetlands, and they're in negotiation for about another 100. The Nature Conservancy received about $3.7 million with the intent to acquire 1,000 acres, of which 870 have been acquired. One of the things I need to stress to you is the department's commitment and ability to provide transparency and accountability in all of our funding sources that we have. Something new, I know the LCC and the Lessard-Sams Council, they have a grant website where all the appropriations they make are being tracked there. We have come up with a complete outcomes tracking database, looking at all of our divisional and bureau data that we have, and also looking at all of the grants we issue, the legacy grants, grant outcomes website, budgeting for results, conservation agendas that we have. But you can go to this website. This is what it looks like here. And maybe when we can go live sometime and check on any county within the state. And any county will show you any type of grant that they've got from the DNR, whether it be a federal pass-through grant, a legislative pass-through grant, snowmobile grant and aid system there. Really, we can track all of the pass-through dollars that the department is providing to any entity within a county or within your district even from this website. So with the pressures and expectations that the citizens and the legislature have of state government to being open, accountable, and transparent, we've really taken that to heart, and this is just the beginning of that type of work. So I encourage you to take a look at this website, poke around on it, let me know what you think, if you think it's a good thing, if we're missing some stuff. But we really do take to heart making sure that the citizens and you all understand the dollars that you're giving to us and what is being done with them and what the outcomes are from those dollars. So, Mr. Chairman, that was a lot of stuff. I apologize if I went too fast, but thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Time for a couple of questions. Any questions? Otherwise, Commissioner Meyer will be back again later on. But questions? Seeing only Representative Winkler, I will call on him.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to learn.
That's fine.
The plans that I think you specifically mentioned, the Forest Forever, but other kind of stakeholder-developed plans, do you have a way of measuring your progress against the plans? That's what to me would be helpful in this presentation, because you've given us a lot of information, but I have no context. You know, I think at one point in this presentation you talked about the number of wells that were capped. I have no context for understanding whether that's a lot or, you know, that's nothing, or why it's important. So
certainly,
the more we can, for me to understand how the money is being spent to achieve outcomes, you have to measure to get something. So to the extent we can do that would be very helpful.
Commissioner Meyer.
Chairman, Representative Winkler, we will make sure that from now on we frame those things in that kind of context. But I will also get you some more specific information, anybody else who's interested, on the context of those things associated with it. And it's important to realize that the plans that we have, for example, the duck plan or the Citizens Wildlife Management Area plan, these are plans that citizens, our customers, your constituents, spent a lot of their own time, many times months and sometimes a year or two, developing these recommendations and really looking at what the possibilities are and what the needs are, and kind of throwing out a range of opportunities that are there. So it's not the DNR that's coming here asking for these dollars. It's our stakeholders, your constituents, the citizens of the state of Minnesota, telling us we want to do these great things, and we want to be able to hunt and fish and snowmobile and snowshoe and cross-country ski and birdwatch and all those things. So we look forward with, I look forward to working with you to make sure that those folks can do all that stuff.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, just a point of information for my own curiosity. Part of your acquisitions include acquiring state forest land, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, under the Forest for the Future program, you can the language that's set up in statute surrounding those that program, under the Outdoor Recreation Act, it allows us to purchase by fee title or easement. So in some cases where fee title is nearly the same cost as an easement would be, we evaluate on a case-by-case basis, and we would do fee title maybe 5% of the time. Most of it is a perpetual easement at the state level.
And when...
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you acquire these lands that are then our state forests, what happens to the income that is generated by those, if assuming that some of them are logged?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that is a conversation we'll have with in-depth in the Environment Policy and Finance Committee, but 50% of the revenues on state-acquired lands are deposited in the general fund. 50% go to the forest management investment account to be used for forest management activities.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, we... trying to fit all this together with PILT is what I'm kind of trying to wrestle with in my mind. It just, how does that all fit together? You know, can we pay PILT or not pay PILT, but yet we can take income? I have questions that I don't even know how to ask.
Mr. Meyer. Representative Torkelson, and I have answers I don't know how to state, so we can talk about this later on. The PILT thing, that's a whole separate discussion. I think the forestry budget used to be all general fund funded. We tried to get them, develop a mechanism to have the receipts pay for part of that budget. The PILT question is a question that we need to spend some time on and look at not only what PILT is, maybe what it can be, and what are some other alternatives that are out there as well. So I know we don't have time for that today, but I look forward to talking with you separately and as a group on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Commissioner Meyer. We look forward to your next appearance here.
Thank you.
Now we have the State Historical Society before us. Mr. Fox, Mr. Kelleher, please identify yourselves for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Michael Fox. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society. And like to begin today with some thank yous. To thank the voters of Minnesota who passed the legacy amendment to preserve those things which make Minnesota great. To thank all the Minnesotans who have contributed to this great initiative with a small proportion of the sales tax. To the members of the legislature, particularly the legacy committee, who helped provide this funding and the guidance to get this program off the ground. And finally, I would say personally, I'm thankful that I'm here testifying at 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon and not sometime after midnight, as was the case 2 years ago. That levity aside, as I look around the room, there are a number of our partners are here, people we've worked with, either as recipients of grants or as partnerships on the various legacy projects from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Acknowledge their contribution and their presence in the room with us today. A week ago, last Friday actually, we submitted to the legislature this report outlining the work that the Historical Society did under the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. My colleague David Kelleher will speak about that in detail in a minute, but first I'd like to offer a few highlights, some general observations about our work with these funds. The Society is extremely proud, and I think our history partners are as well, of the work that's been accomplished with this appropriation. I think the expression of support for these funds from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund validates the idea that the preservation of the state's history and cultural heritage is an important value to Minnesotans. A few highlights of the work that we've done over the last 18 months. The legacy funds are building a better future for all of Minnesotans, particularly in the area of education, one of the highest goals of Minnesotans and their elected officials. With these projects, we have served over 100,000 students statewide and over 5,000 teachers. We've helped to train teachers to make them more effective in the classroom, and we've helped provide access through technology and financial support for students through field trips. We're preserving treasured historical resources and creating unprecedented access to them by putting materials up on the web, by helping to support school trips to historic sites and museums across the state, and through a traveling exhibit program. We have found that the legacy funds are in fact building a positive economic benefit for the state. We are boosting economies locally and statewide on projects that are in Minnesota for Minnesotans. The legacy funds managed by the Historical Society have allowed more than 1,300 businesses and organizations in the state to create jobs and to extend services. We asked the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality to assess the economic impact of the programs that we were administering. And the report back to us is that for every $1 invested, the state has received a return of $1.95. We believe this is a positive economic benefit. I would observe that the Society and our partners statewide are gratified by the expression of confidence in our work. The current appropriation structure appropriately recognizes that there are projects of statewide scope, scale, and significance that work well when they're administered by a statewide organization like the Minnesota Historical Society, and that there are also a range of projects of local and regional significance that are best done by our local and regional partners. We believe that the grants program that was set up in the appropriation for this biennium and conducted by a citizen panel set up by the legislative appropriation, volunteer citizens from all across the state, has proven to be an effective mechanism for distributing those funds through a proven process. The Historical Society has been making grants from a variety of state and federal funds for over 42 years. And finally, I would note that we believe that the Society has been an effective and efficient steward of these funds. We are measuring the results of these projects. All of our grant applicants must state the outcomes that they expect to produce as a result of these funds. We have been engaging outside consultants to assess our own work. We're not relying on our own self-assessment, but we've asked people to come in and to review our work to assure that our projects are meeting the goals that we've set forward. We've also been working with the Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul more generally to help our society staff build their own capacity to plan and evaluate projects. They're being funded as a result of this appropriation, but in fact all of our work. We have communicated with the public at every phase of this process. We have held 44 meetings statewide, attended by 1,700 individuals, as we prepared, administered, and then ask for a review of the work that we have done. The citizens of Minnesota can track the expenditures through a very transparent report that you have in front of you, and through a website that we've had since summer of 2009. There's a lot of conversation in the press, in the media, that people don't know where this money is going. How is it being spent? Is it being spent to good use? And we believe that we have done a strong job of communicating the work that we are doing. We know we can always improve on that, and we will strive to do so. We met with the legislative auditor and the Office of Grants Management early on to ensure that all our procedures were consistent with sound fiscal practices. We continue to monitor these projects and all of the grants that we've made. Awarding a grant is actually only the first step of the process. We need to continually monitor, to review with the grant applicants their work, to ensure that they are meeting the purposes and outcomes of the projects, and that they are expending funds in accordance with their budgets and sound fiscal procedures. And finally, I think it's fair to say that we have worked very diligently to respect the intent of the legacy amendment, to create legacies for all Minnesotans in ways that supplement traditional sources of funding rather than supplementing those traditional, or rather than substituting for those traditional sources. We are very proud, as I say, of the work that we've done. Mr. Kelleher is going to walk us through the report and show us a video that illustrates some of the work that we have done. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Fox. Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Thanks again for the opportunity to present this report. I'm just going to take a very quick second and walk you through how this is organized, and then if technology will cooperate, bring the voices of others in who have worked on the projects from the legacy amendment appropriations and have them tell you about the work that's gone on around the state in the history category. You have this report in your packets, and then there's a sheet that looks like this. We've organized the report according to the appropriation categories that you made in the legislation 2 years ago. The first and one of the larger categories is the grants program, where we have accomplished quite a bit. There were 474 grants awarded in all 87 counties to 343 recipient organizations. And Mr. Chair, I think you were asking others how many were turned down. There were about 400 unsuccessful. Some of those folks came back for another round, improved their application, and achieved success in a subsequent round.
How many did you say were approved?
474 grants were approved.
Thank you.
And all 87 counties across the state. So the report is organized that you can see the tabs on the side for each of the appropriation categories. The next category is the statewide historical programs, and that section contains descriptions of some 40 programs where we focused on education, access to history across the state, and those are statewide programs operated primarily by the Minnesota Historical Society.
And Mr. Kelleher, I haven't had a lot of time to look at this in any depth or detail, but I just want to commend you on what I've seen from the report so far. I think if there are those seeking a model for what to do in terms of these reports, this is a good one to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Our staff worked hard to put this together. There's a lot of information contained. We have a capsule description of each of the 474 grants that went out so that you can get a sense of how the money was spent. The next few categories include the partnership category, and as Mr. Fox said, as we look around the room today, there are many, many people with whom we've worked, both from this appropriation and from other appropriations. So your charge to us was work together, and we've done that in many cases to bring history through libraries and other organizations to the public. The next tab or category is an exhibit. You created an appropriation category for that, and interestingly, one of the previous testifiers talked about the biomes. We very loosely based the organization of that exhibit on the ecological regions of Minnesota. So the ecology of the state informs the history, and that's how students will learn. So that exhibit will be opening in 2012 at the History Center to teach kids about our state's history. It's tied to the social studies standards that are mandated, and look forward to lots of learning and fun for kids of all ages from that. And then finally, the last two, the statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites, an appropriation was made for that. There are a number of small projects that resulted from that. Significant work has begun in that area. And then the Minnesota Digital Library, where information about Minnesota's past is preserved and made accessible to people 24/7 anywhere in the world. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to attempt to get the video going, and maybe this is a time for questions to Mr. Fox.
First, Mr. Kelleher, did you say that they're going to attempt to survey all the state archaeological sites?
Not at once, Mr. Chair.
You're not
over time, we will take a crack at doing that, but that's a task that's bigger than the appropriations in that category or our category.
So you're maybe not getting to my place this summer?
Perhaps next summer.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, here goes. Again, rather than having me drone on any longer, we'll have the voices of the people who did this work.
The Legacy Amendment is making history in Minnesota.
This is once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Legacy funds are giving Minnesotans unprecedented access to history.
And we really have been able to reach all corners of the state.
They're boosting economies.
I want to see all these buildings come to life.
They're preserving our state's priceless historical resources.
This is the area where they had the old encampment.
Legacy funds are helping 30,000 more students experience history field trips this school year by cutting the high cost of transportation.
Bonjour!
Legacy funds are beaming live, active history lessons performed in St. Paul.
Dakota Elder, why are you called an elder?
Into classrooms across the state.
I am an older member of my tribe who is respected for my wisdom.
Using video conferencing technology.
Kids learning is about them being active, them being involved in the story because that's what resonates with them.
Legacy funds are creating a revolutionary exhibit about Minnesota.
We are testing some new exhibit components.
Now under construction at the History Center.
Instead of asking kids to put their technology away, to encourage them to use it to learn.
The exhibit will connect tech-savvy students to Minnesota's past like never before.
The legacy funding is allowing us to be cutting edge and a leader in the field of museums.
There you go. Go for it, guys.
Legacy funds are breathing new life into Minnesota communities.
You want a cheese curd?
Business leaders are learning how to revitalize their historic downtowns.
In order to get something done in a community, you have to all pull together and have common language and common vision, and the legacy dollars, the training we've gone through has helped us achieve that.
In North Minneapolis,
this is our state's highest concentrated area of unemployment.
Legacy funds are transforming the historic North Branch Library into a 21st century career and technology center.
In our current economic times, is our ability to get people to work. It is really the great use of taxpayer dollars.
Legacy funds are allowing Minnesotans to discover the past.
Can't save it unless you know where it is.
And preserve it. At Leech Lake.
I could, in my mind, picture wigwams. Sometimes they had teepees.
Legacy funds are helping secure a remarkable discovery, a fur trade post from the early 1800s, and a sacred Ojibwe village from the 1700s.
The more we could dig up and learn from it, it'd help the future generations.
And legacy money is making it easier than ever for all Minnesotans to access historical materials.
We are essentially making
things available in ways that were never possible, never even be dreamed of 10 or 15 years ago.
Thousands more historical documents, pictures, and newspapers, all available online to anyone, anywhere, anytime.
Does anybody like sugar here?
Yes, legacy funds are making history in Minnesota, creating new opportunities for students, revitalizing communities, preserving our past, and delivering more history to more Minnesotans than ever before.
Our work has just started. It's just started, and we have a lot more to do.
And with the legacy funding, this has given us a huge opportunity to meet the needs of the people of Minnesota.
Thank you. That was very
Mr.
good.
Mr. Chairman, the final thing that we have at the very end of the video, there's a web address. And just as Mr. Meyer said with the DNR, we have, I won't show it to you now, but we have a website that tracks all the expenditures in the history category from legacy amendments. You can do a search by city, county, legislative district, theme, terms, whatever. So to answer the question, where did the money go, you can track every dollar through that website. So I would, just as Mr. Meyer said, we would encourage you to check out the website, surf it, test it out, see if it works for your needs, and we'll help you track the dollars and help your constituents track the dollars from the legacy amendment. So with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have.
Okay, questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you have people helping people that were interested in those small grants?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, absolutely. One of our big goals in this process is to increase capacity of the folks that are doing history around the state, and whether that's helping them to write grant applications or helping them to do their history, that's a goal that we have. We have a pre-application process, so people get a couple of shots to get it right. They submit a pre-application to our staff. Our staff works with them, makes suggestions on improving the application before it goes before the Citizen Committee, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee, which is very competitive. They're critical because there's a lot of competition. So we have helped applicants on the front end and while they're doing their projects.
Representative Murphy. Mr. Chair, Mr. Keller, did that change then? You said at first place there were 474, I think, grants, and then some people reapplied and were helped. Were there 400 then left forever until the next round of money, or were the 400 that you said didn't make it? Is that a smaller number now?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but a few came back for the second round, and the list filled up after that. In other words, there are still many, many, many more applications out there. I think as people learn more about the grant program, there will be many people coming in applying for grants. So we haven't filled all the needs. I think your question is, if we satisfied all the needs after the first round, are there any left? Absolutely not. There's a lot more. Where those come from.
Thank you.
Other questions? Just one more, Mr. Kelleher or Director Fox. It seems that most of the grants are, you know, relatively modest amounts. Do you have any figures? How many over $100,000 were given, or what the average grant was?
Mr. Chairman, I can answer that in general. I don't have the specifics, but we could provide that very quickly. In the public meetings that we held before we set up the grants project, we asked the people who were attending how they thought the money should be distributed. It should go to a few very large grants, all very small grants. And the consensus seemed to be that there would be grants at small, medium, and large levels. And so the program divided grants into projects that were under 7,000, between 50,000, and then over 50,000. So we had the small grants, the mid-size, and the large grants. and as you might imagine, and that we would allocate the funds equally within those three categories. So you could understand that, for instance, in the current year, there were 378 of the small grants and 126 of the mid and large size grants, and so that the average size of those is considerably larger. But the breakdowns, I'm not sure the dollar, I think the dollar amounts are in the report. One could do that calculation, but we could certainly provide you with that statistical information.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? All right, I've stifled the urge to recite any poetry today, so we'll excuse you. Thank you very much. Look
thank
forward
you,
to hearing
Chair.
From you.
Thank you,
later.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Now we have the State Arts Board. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Sharon. I'm Dean for the School of the Arts at St. Mary's University in Winona, Minnesota, and the current chair of the Minnesota State Arts Board. And with me, I have Sue Jens.
I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board.
And Mr. Sharon is also a former representative, Mike Sharon.
I did have the honor, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did have the honor of serving with several of you, and it's good to see you all again.
Welcome and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As many of you know, the State Arts Board is made up of 11 appointed members, all appointed by the governor for oversight of this particular state agency. With the passage of the legacy amendment, the board felt that it must take advantage of this tremendous opportunity to do a comprehensive overview of every program that the State Arts Board was sponsoring. And over the last 2 years, we have, I feel, effectively done that, and we'll hear more about that from the Executive Director. We took a look at every single strategy, goal, and outcome, and how those outcomes might be assessed, and looked at efficiency and maximum effect. Really, we thought that as we went into this new era here in Minnesota, that the idea was not to do the same old with just more money thrown at it, that we really must look at every single program. I guess the board itself is very tired. Well, they may or may not be tired of hearing my mantra of every meeting practically saying, this is not our money. That every child buys a piece of penny candy to every senior citizen is contributing to the legacy funds. To talk more specifics about our comprehensive overview and the programs that we're now offering to the citizens of Minnesota, I turn this over to Sue Jens, the Executive Director.
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm delighted to have a chance to reacquaint some of you with the Arts Board. I know that some members were on the committee 2 years ago when the first appropriations were made. Since we see a number of new faces around the table, I'll also try to give you an overview of who we are, who our partners, the regional arts councils, are, and how we believe we're providing important service to the state of Minnesota. And we have the PowerPoint. I'll lead you through that somewhat quickly. And from time to time, I will be referring to the report that we provided to all of you a few weeks ago as well. They're companion pieces in many ways. Just a little bit of background on the agency. We are what's considered a non-cabinet-level executive agency in the state of Minnesota. Our authorizing statute, 129D, outlines our responsibilities, the duties of our board members, the expectations, and how we will go about our business. And so we are a regular part of state government. We are responsible for all of the same kinds of oversight and accountability that the Department of Natural Resources or the Department of Education has. Obviously, they are much, much larger than we are, but we are a state agency. Some of you might remember my trivia, history trivia quiz from a few years ago. Minnesota has had a state agency dedicated to the arts for more than 100 years. In 1903, the first state arts agency was created within the state government to do many of the same things that we're asked to do now, which is to integrate the arts into the lives, the communities, and the businesses of our state. We were the second in the country. Utah beat us by about 4 years. And also in 1977, we were the second state in the country to create a decentralized system of funding for the arts. So much like the federal system and the state system, we have a central state agency, and then we have partners at our regional arts councils. That system's been in place for about 30 years. It's worked well, and in fact, many other states have been following our model. So why have a state arts agency? Why does it make sense for the arts to be a part of state government? Well, it matters. It makes sense because Minnesotans care about the arts. The next few slides in your packet give you some statistics about the fact that two-thirds of Minnesotans are actively engaged in the arts. 82% of Minnesotans think that public funding is vital to the arts. Otherwise, it might be left only to those people who have adequate means or sufficient means, and we want the arts to be available and accessible all around the state. Many Minnesotans understand the value of arts in education and how the ways that the creative mind opens up to learning really has an impact on the overall achievement of students. And finally, we care about the arts because they're one of the things that attracts new businesses, new residents, and visitors who want to come and live and work in our state. So these are a few of the things that make the arts important to Minnesotans. One of the things that might make the arts important to those of you around the table who are needing to wrestle with jobs and moving our economy forward is that the arts is an important industry in the state. Collectively, we're about a $1 billion industry, and that's both nonprofit arts organizations and individual artists. Our organizations, about 1,400 of them, contribute $840 million per year in economic activity. A big chunk of that comes in through state and local tax revenue. And our individual artists, many of whom are small businesses, sole proprietorships, are contributing about $200 million a year to our economy. Again, there's a substantial local and state government revenue component to that. We also contribute to the state in a number of ways that are not specifically financial. We are involved with helping redevelop communities and neighborhoods. Many of us know about small towns or about neighborhoods that are perhaps in decay that have been brought back because of an arts presence. We know about the value the arts provide in bridging new cultures. This is an increasingly diverse state, and it's important for us to understand one another through the stories and the traditions that we share. Arts are important in tourism. Arts help to fuel the new economies. We're hearing more and more about moving away from some of the hand-based or the physical industries more into the conceptual industries, the creative industries, and the role that the arts play in stimulating that imagination. The arts bring visibility to our state. They contribute to successful futures of children. So we think that we help the state in a variety of ways. And our goal at the Arts Board is that all Minnesotans should have a chance to benefit from the arts, whether that is as a participant, as an audience member, or just as the person whose business happens to be down the street from the Arts Center and who sees an increase in business on a Saturday night when there's a performance happening. So that's our goal. Very quickly, a little bit about our structure. Here we have Minnesotans participating in the arts. As Mr. Chiron said, we have 11 board members appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate. That's one from each of the 8 congressional districts and then an at-large member. We rely very heavily on citizen volunteers. We are absolutely citizen-driven. More than 100, and this year closer to 200 volunteers will help us do our work. We recruit from all over the state, and we just could not function without them because, as you see at the bottom of the slide, we are a full-time staff of 11. So we are very small in comparison to some of the other agencies that you'll hear from today. I mentioned earlier this two-tiered system, the State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. There are 11. 9 of them are independent nonprofit organizations. 2 of them are about to become independent nonprofits. They have been part of a regional development commission, and they are about to split and become independent. We believe the value of this two-tiered structure is obvious, that I think it was Mr. Fox from the Historical Society said there are some projects that have the scope and the impact that really require statewide funding or statewide attention. There are some things that really are best left to local decision makers because of the local impact they'll have. Regional Arts Council's job is to develop programs and services specifically tailored to meet the needs of their region. So you can imagine how different the needs might be in the Arrowhead region versus the Bluff Country in southeastern Minnesota. It's their job to understand that and provide the best service they can. We all do a similar and a variety of things. Grant making is the biggest thing that we do. Very little of the funds that come to the Arts Board or to the Regional Arts Council stay with us. We don't do a lot of direct programming. We do some of that. But mostly what we do is we turn those dollars around and use them as a catalyst to stimulate other activities. We do professional development to try and increase the capacity of the nonprofit sector, to increase the capacity of individual artists. Our agency is involved with ADA compliance because we're also federally funded. And over and above it all, our job is to connect Minnesotans to the arts. Just a bit about our grants process. Some of the other agencies have talked to you about how they manage their grant making. Our process in the Regional Arts Councils is similar. There's a staff function, there's a committee function, and a board function. Staff roles, obviously, are the preparation work, a lot of technical assistance helping applicants understand the goals of the programs and prepare strong applications. We facilitate committees, and then we do all of the follow-up, the grant contracts, and the management of those contracts. Our advisory committees is the heart of the work, and I'll come back to them in just a moment. But our advisory committees come up with a list of recommended grants which go to our board, and our board has final authority for all of the grant making we do. The same is true for each of the Regional Arts Councils. Their boards are responsible for the funds that they have available for grant making. And because I've mentioned it several times, just a couple of things about those advisory committee members. People nominate themselves, are self-nominated, are recruited. We require people who are knowledgeable about the arts and understand how the nonprofit sector works. Generally, we have 7 to 10 advisors per committee, and we can have, I remember last April, we had a committee meeting every single day except one, so we use a lot of committees. All of our committees follow open meeting laws. They're open to the public. Applicants and members of the general public are welcome to attend. We have a conflict of interest policy, and they serve for free. We reimburse them for their expenses, but basically they are there because they want to help the state make good investments with those funds. Very quickly, just a summary of our funding for fiscal 10. I just picked one fiscal year because for us, the two fiscal years look very similar. You'll see that the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils are funded both by state general fund dollars. That's about $8.4 million, and the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars for fiscal 10 were $21.65 million. Clearly, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has made a huge difference in our work and the impact that we can have. As Mr. Sharon said, we spent a great deal of time at the beginning of fiscal year 10 collecting public input, doing planning, coming up with a set of guiding principles and a strategic vision that was in the report that we gave you. And then in the second 6 months of the year, we rolled out all of our new grant programs and services. So for us, most of our grant making for fiscal 10 was done in the last month or two of fiscal 10, so May and June of last year, which means that those are one-year projects, and within the next few months we'll start getting final reports for them. We'll start to be able to measure the impact of what those dollars have been able to do. This first year will be our baseline, and going forward we'll be able to see the improvements over time.
Ms. Jens?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman.
I'd just like to ask a question first here. And then. One of the questions that has been coming before us deals with the administrative cost oversight. I see that for the State Arts Board, $550,000 and nothing for the Regional Arts Councils. And what I've heard is that the administrative oversight was a higher amount, a higher percentage with Regional Arts Councils. Could you shed some light on that and what you see as the needs for that?
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to respond to that. when the Arts Board historically has received an appropriation from the legislature, there have been three lines in the appropriation. There's been a line for block grants to regional arts councils. There's been a line to grants that the Arts Board manages, grant programs that the Arts Board manages. And then there's been a line that's been our operations and services line. And so these two lines that you see at the bottom really are those comparable lines. Going back at least 10 years, possibly the full 30 years that we've had this system, the legislature has not specifically outlined what portion or percentage of those Regional Arts Council block grants is to be used for administrative costs and what percentage is to be used for other kinds of programs or grants. The legislature has left that decision and managing that relationship to us. And we have a standard in place that says 15 to 20% of the costs, up to 15 to 20% of the costs, could be used for those. We know that those costs are much less than that, and in fact, some of you may know that the legislative auditor looked at those costs last year and found that in all cases they were less than that, often substantially less.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jens. Did someone else have a question? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Is it in your plan that we'll discuss this more in depth at a later time?
They will be coming to us with their requests for funding, and we'll be able to go into more depth.
I think it would be better. Let's hold that.
Okay. Thank you. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the report that we provided you will be the best overview of all the various investments that we made from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars. And in the interest of time and the hour, I won't go page by page through that. But simply to say, as Mr. Chiron had mentioned, the Arts Board, the funds that it had available from the legacy dollars, it invested in two existing programs, supplemented them, the support that we provide, the basic support that we provide to arts organizations and to individuals. But we also invented seven brand new grant programs, all of which are meant to be incentive programs to encourage certain kinds of behavior. And all seven of those are really about providing greater access and more ways for Minnesotans to engage in the arts. So all seven of the grant programs that we outlined in our report, we gave you the examples of what the expected outcomes are, and each of the grantees were expected to address those in their proposals, and they'll have to report back to us on how they're achieving those outcomes. We know that those dollars are going all throughout the state. They're reaching all sorts of different areas, and part of what we try to achieve is to move artists and arts organizations from their own home communities to other places. And so, for example, we have the Mixed Blood Theater, which is a Twin Cities organization, touring to Baudette and Crookston, but also as far south as Casson and St. Peter. The idea that geography should be the barrier is something that we wanted to overcome in that one program. In our arts learning program, we have artists from southern Minnesota working with a senior center in Granite Falls on storytelling, writing stories. And so we're really trying to move arts and arts activities around and make them much more available. And I'm happy to give you some more details about that, but I think what I'll do is I'll go on and then leave time at the end for questions. The regional arts councils also did similar things. They invested some of the new funds in their existing programs to supplement them. Our system has been quite significantly underfunded, we have felt, for some time, and so we invested in core programs. And then the regional arts councils also created new activities, and I've given you just a couple of examples here. In the report, it's about 40 pages of information, so just to quickly summarize that, one of the regional arts councils has created an ADA access improvement program to put in a ramp or possibly buy some equipment to help arts facilities be more accessible to people with disabilities. We have student mentor programs in a number of the regions where a high school student might be able to work with a professional artist to learn and to train and to understand what that career choice might be like if he or she were to pursue it. Many of the regional arts council many of the regional arts councils have created programs that will bring more public art to their communities. And I know that a few years ago I was invited to speak at the League of Minnesota Cities Conference, and so many of those representatives at that conference came to me and said, we'd like to put a statue in, we'd like to put in a sculpture, we'd like a centerpiece in our community. How would we do that? So we think that this is a program that will meet some important needs. You've asked several of the other presenters today about numbers, how many requests, how many grants, and I've given you just a very quick snapshot of that. In our case, the number of requests that we had for funding this year was nearly 1,500 applications. That's a 130% increase over the year before. We were able to award 648 grants. Again, that's a 70% increase over what we were able to fund before. We were able to fund about 40% of the applications that came to us. So 60% of them we didn't have resources to fund. In the case of the Regional Arts Councils, they entertained over 2,000 applications. They awarded 1,500 grants. The number of requests was a 65% increase, and the number of grants was a 70% increase. So I know we all thought that this was an amazing amount of money, and when people started to imagine what they could do with it, when artists and arts groups and community groups and communities all around the state started to think about ways that the arts could enhance their lives and their communities, the applications really started to flow. And we think that as the word spreads, as there are successful projects and programs, the demand will only grow greater in the future. So just finally, you all know, you're all aware of the language of the Constitution. We believe that we have tried to build programs and services that will address all four of the elements that are written into the state constitution language. We think this is a tremendous opportunity to invest in the creativity and the identity and the success of our state. We are really proud and pleased to play a significant role in helping to provide stewardship for these dollars. And we look forward to keeping you informed as our first-year grantees finish their projects and as this year's grantees begin theirs. So we'll be happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I'll just close then with Chair Murphy.
Would you like to tell us what has been completed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Yes.
Murphy, do I take your meaning?
I think so.
Oh. I don't know if Mr. Myers is still here. I don't think so. I believe that you're referring to the logo. Am I correct?
That's correct.
The 2009 appropriations bill included language that said there would be a logo that would be used to identify every project, not just the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund projects, but the outdoor heritage, the clean water and land, and clean water, and the parks and trails. That work was completed most recently, and it was a great advantage. When the project started, we were working on it alone. Last year, the legislature suggested we work with the Department of Natural Resources, which was tremendous because their communication staff is bigger than our entire staff. So it was very nice to be able to work with them, and that's now been finished. And I think you saw the logo on the DNR presentation, and very soon you'll be seeing it on not only all of our materials, but also on our grantees' materials.
On all grantees.
All grantees' materials.
Thank you, Ms. Jens. Anyone else? I'll just say this. I had intended to have the state archaeologist. I can say that word. I had intended to have him today. We'll maybe try to lead him off with him tomorrow. We'll contact him, but Mr. Kelleher, if you run into him. Anything else? Thank you very much. We're adjourned.